Welcome, everybody, to the Transportation Finance Committee for March 13th. I'm State Representative Frank Hornstein. Before we move into our agenda, I want to first make a couple of announcements. We have folks from the Beacon Home School in Lino Lakes. Did I get that right? Thank you for attending our committee. They are participating in the Capitol Historic Sites Voice of the People, Your Role in Minnesota Government Tour and Education Program. So we're very happy that you're here visiting us today, and appreciate your being here. We have just a couple of agenda items and a couple of announcements that I want to make. I'm probably going to make this announcement twice because it's important, and I want to make sure that those members that are here and may need to leave later hear it, and then for our members that are coming later, they should hear it as well. So in terms of this committee schedule for next week, right now we have our normal schedule with a couple of exceptions. On Wednesday during the day, we're going to hear the funding bill, the large funding bill, finance bill for transportation. During the day on Wednesday, and we'll have time for opponents and supporters during committee, and then we'll come back in the evening and do amendments. So that's for Wednesday evening. I want people to plan ahead. This is a big bill with a lot of discussion and probably several amendments. So I wouldn't anticipate meeting for longer than a couple hours, but we don't want to run up into our time constraint with that. So that's our tentative plan. And on the issue of amendments to the big bill, I'm going to enforce a 24-hour rule so everybody can know what's coming. And so I would ask people to get their amendments to our committee administrator, Matt Scheer, by about 10 a.m. on Tuesday morning. So, and if you need an hour more, fine, but so maybe it's a 23-hour rule, but really try to get it invited. I know sometimes things happen, and Matt will be very busy. Mr. Burris will be busy. So, let's just say late morning on Tuesday, get those in. Absolutely no later than noon on Tuesday. No, not 1 o'clock. So is everyone clear on that? And then if we can get our work done in the allotted time, we won't need to meet extra meetings next week, but there are other bills coming at this committee that I don't know about, and we want to get them heard before deadline. So, again, that next week is the week to be a little flexible. And, I don't anticipate too much extra, but please pay attention, and we'll try to get word out as soon as possible regarding extra meetings. But at this point, we'll just go into Wednesday evening, I think, for the big funding bill. And I wanted to give everybody a heads up. And then Tuesday morning for amendments. Representative O'Neill.
Do you have an approximate time and location on Wednesday?
Here, if we can, we'll work on getting this room. And 6:30? Yeah, that's right. We have the same issues we had yesterday with caucus. So 6:30 or 7. Evening. Okay, I'm going to just review this one more time. During the day on Wednesday, we're going to hear citizen testimony on our big funding bill. We're going to do amendments and markup in the evening. Okay? Amendments need to be in Tuesday morning. Now, for the DFL members, immediately after our hearing today, we're going to have a brief caucus. And where is that going to be? 400 North. 400 North DFL.
Today?
Right after this hearing, which will end early, I think. Okay? So you should have it on your committee calendar that you're booked till 11:30, I hope. Okay, any questions? All right, so we have two items on the agenda today. Just for those of you who are following the Earhart No Talking on Cell Phones and Work Zone bill, there is a fiscal note in process that apparently we're going to get soon. So the way we're going to do this is that we'll have a presentation from MnDOT first, and then we'll go into the Earhart Safety Zone bill, and then we'll adjourn. So the genesis of this presentation is, and you, we'll have more background on this, but MnDOT convened a group to talk about return on investment for roads and bridges. And, you know, we've heard a lot about this ROI in the context of the Itasca project report last year. But now MnDOT did this through a stakeholder group, and very interesting in terms of transportation finance and where we need to go. And I thought it would be very helpful for the committee, especially as we, before we dive into some funding and finance issues, to hear from MnDOT about this process. So with that, we'll start. And welcome to the committee, and please state your name for the record.
All right. Thank you, Mr. Chairman, and good morning, everyone. My name is Eric Davis. I'm the Chief of Staff at the Minnesota Department of Transportation, Chief of Staff to Commissioner Zelli, and it's my privilege to be here this morning. I wanted to share with you a bit about our study, Return on Investment of Highway Bridges, Highways and Bridge Projects. As the Chairman alluded to, there was a similar study conducted, sponsored by the Itasca Group, that looked at transit investments, and so we wanted to take a similar examination of state highway and bridge projects. The state highway system in Minnesota today operates at a high level. We meet most all of the performance goals that we set for the system today. However, over the next 20 years, MnDOT anticipates to experience a steady decline in the performance of that system as state transportation revenues of an estimated $18 billion are unable to keep pace with the needs created by Minnesota's growing population and aging infrastructure. Governor Dayton, Commissioner of Transportation, Finance, and Advisory Committee, most of you are familiar with that work, and the TFAC, as we refer to it, recommended that the state invest an additional $12 billion over the next 20 years, first to maintain the current performance of the state highway system, the current condition and performance of the state highway system, and then ensuring that the system is economically competitive. MnDOT partnered with an organization called Smart Growth America to evaluate and understand the potential return on investment of these TFAC, these additional transportation funds recommended by TFAC. The Smart Growth America is a national organization. It works with state departments of transportation across the country to identify transportation policies and programs that enable effective, flexible, and efficient ways to increase the capacity to move people, goods, and services on state transportation systems. This project team conducted its study over a period of 3 months. It began in August 2013 and published its final report in November of 2013. The report was produced with the support of the McKnight Foundation, sponsored by the Chamber of Commerce. The team had three working meetings with a project stakeholder group. The project stakeholder group had over 63 representatives from public, private, nonprofit sectors who served as a sounding board throughout the study and provided valuable input to this ROA assessment. Just a quick refresher on the Transportation Finance Advisory Committee's work. Governor charged the TFAC group with identifying the needs and solutions for transportation over a long-term outlook, 20-year outlook. Not surprisingly, the committee came to the conclusion that needs outpace the revenue. Committee comprised of local government, labor and industry, transportation professionals, and it was headed, we heard from private citizens, business leaders, and advocacy groups on finance and infrastructure issues. Over the next 20 years, the needs that were identified were significant and greatly outpaced the revenue projections. Ultimately, we identified $50 billion in investments needed over the next 20 years for all modes to create an economically competitive system. This would be for all modes, all systems. And for the state highway bridges and roads alone, we estimate a gap of $12 billion in funding. $30 billion need offset by $18 billion in forecast revenue. The Transportation Finance Advisory Committee was asked to consider three funding scenarios. One was status quo. What are the consequences of no new funding or investments in the transportation system beyond those that were already forecast? A second scenario was what would be needed to maintain the existing performance on the existing system at current levels. And the third was an economically competitive scenario. In the first instance, to maintain performance, we estimate an additional $5 billion in investments over the next 20 years needed to maintain system performance at current levels. And to serve a 21st century economy, the TFAC recommended an additional $12 billion over the current level. So that's 5 plus an additional 7 to total $12 billion in investments over the next 20 years.
Mr. Davis, I have a quick question on that slide. When you talk about maintained performance, is that simply, you know, filling potholes, making sure the roads are drivable? You know, there's the MnDOT pavement study that talks about the problems we're going to have in 2020 if we don't do maintenance. Is that the category? We took actually a fascinating trip. I don't know if you heard about it. Some of us up to the test facility on I-94 and learned a lot about pavement. And one of my takeaways is that, you know, we're pretty vulnerable on that. When you talk about maintenance, is that what we're talking about here?
Mr. Chairman, thank you for that question. What we're talking about with maintaining performance is maintaining the system in its current condition and performance level. So we would make investments in the infrastructure over time, $5 billion additional dollars in investment, just to keep the system in its current condition and current performance. We would estimate that bridge and pavement conditions would remain the same as they are today with this level of investment. Fatalities would likely continue to drop with better technologies. Congestion levels would likely increase, however, and we would make spot improvements. There would be few, if any, expansions in any corridor.
So this is $5 billion of new money to maintain what we currently have?
That's correct.
Okay. Thank you.
We asked the Smart Growth America group to assist us in return on investment on three key questions. And the first is stated there. It's to maintain the current performance of our state highway system will require an investment of an additional $5 billion over the next 20 years. What would be the return? Secondarily, we asked them to help us to become more economically competitive through technology and operational innovation, and projects to reduce congestion and delay would require an estimated $7 billion additional funds over the next 20 years. What would be the return on that investment? And lastly, we asked Smart Growth America to help us within the proposed investments, the menu of things that we could do over the next 20 years. Some projects and programs inevitably will have a higher return on investment. What kinds of projects and programs offer us the highest return? I do want to clarify for the benefit of the committee that when we talk about a return on investment, it's a very straightforward. Project benefits, anticipated benefits, divided by project costs or anticipated costs. So we don't look at things like induced benefits from investments or necessarily try to consider the time value of money by accelerating projects. This is a straight, very simple, what are the anticipated benefits quantified divided by the anticipated costs. And we look at benefits that are quantifiable. We look at the vehicle operating costs, so the cost to operate a vehicle for citizens. We looked at the life cycle cost of the asset, maintaining the asset and over its life cycle at the optimum level. We looked at travel time savings, and we looked at safety benefits as well. So reduced vehicle wear and tear, passenger safety, improved vehicle performance and efficiency, reduced trek time, those are the benefits that we quantified and calculated. Just a few words about life cycle costs. I think many of you have seen this slide. We've been showing it to folks to help people appreciate the importance of making the right treatment at the right pavement at the right time. To maximize the life cycle and performance of a given asset at the minimum cost. And so if we miss those any of those windows, either applying the wrong treatment to the right payment at the wrong time costs taxpayers more money. Applying to the wrong payment obviously costs more, and applying it at the wrong time costs more. This slide is a bit complex, but the message is very simple. We started with a couple of existing documents, our Minnesota State Highway Investment Plan, commonly referred to as MNCHIP, And we talked, and we just also started with the Transportation Finance Advisory Committee's work. And they looked at investments in four categories. Highway reconstruction, addressing deficient bridges or functionally obsolete bridges, mitigating congestion, and highway safety improvements.
Mr. Davis, sorry, I have a question from Representative Johnson. And members, you know, we're going to just, I think it's informal enough here that if people have questions about what's in front of us, we should do that rather than have Mr. Davis go back. So we'll just have a conversation more today rather than Q&A at the end. So Representative Johnson.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, and I'm sorry to interrupt, but I'm curious, you listed, and I didn't find it on the slide, what you're identifying as benefits and how you quantify benefits. Would you list those again for me and talk about that a little bit?
Mr. Chair and Representative Johnson, thank you for that question and opportunity to clarify. So when we look at, we were focused on quantifying the study, rather, focused on quantifying enduring tangible transportation benefits. So estimates such as vehicle operating cost savings, enhanced safety benefits, travel time savings, the optimum life cycle cost of managing the asset, and those benefits were divided by the project costs. Benefits did not include things like construction employment or other induced benefits, the kind of field of dreams concept, if you build it, they will come kind of thing. So we focused on reduced vehicle wear and tear, enhanced vehicle and passenger safety, improved vehicle performance and efficiency, reduced trip travel time, enhanced travel time reliability, the reduced cost for shipping goods and services, reduced crashes and injuries, and reduced property damage from collisions. So those were the factors that went into it.
Representative Johnson, and after your question, I think I have Representative Metza on the list.
I'll just pick on one of those because it became relevant in the assessment of the intersection in Nicollet, Minnesota, which is an important issue where I live. And that is, how do you quantify the safety, personal injuries, and a personal death? And then I have one more question, too.
Okay. Proceed, Mr. Davis.
Mr. Chair and Representative Johnson, we actually do use, I'm going to find it here in my report, we do actually use some data that helps us quantify the cost of a collision that results in an injury or lost life. I would offer this with the disclaimer that life is priceless, and we acknowledge that. So to quantify it for the purposes of something as cold and on its face in personal as return on investment, we look at insurance and other kinds of payouts, and I want to find it precisely, and I may have to get back to the committee with the precise answer because it is contained in the report that informs my presentation today, but I don't want to thumb through it all at your expense of time. It's approximately $7 million, and I'm going to verify that and find that figure.
Representative Johnson.
And then a comment and then a question, and that is that when I've been looking at these benefits, it just as it seems like the focus is a lot of the return on investment stuff is seems focused on congestion and that sort of thing. And when I'm trying to think about the rural roads and the rural transportation, that it seems harder to quantify. How is the department measuring the benefit of, for instance, farm to market, which is fundamental to a good chunk of the state?
Mr. Chairman, Representative Johnson, the calculations on move like farm to market, those calculations, aside from reduced travel time for getting goods to market, those kinds of benefits wouldn't be captured. So the study didn't try to discern whether the goods that are being shipped from one market to another, like the farms to, say, an urban market, would be more or less valuable than another freight or commodity being shipped across the state. So the travel time benefits would be applied, but it would be applied without regard to what was being shipped.
Okay. All right, good. We'll have Representative Metza followed by Representative Benson.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And just a quick question. Did this take into consideration, I know when a project is budgeted, say, for $60 million and it comes to the actual cost of the project being much, much more, the department hands may be tied in funding that gap. Is there a cost associated with that towards any of the towards zero death or any of the other programs that was taken into consideration?
Mr. Davis.
Mr. Chairman, and thank you for the question. The study necessarily works in estimates, and although those estimates are derived from actual past costs, but it does not get into what I would call a more robust or comprehensive review of a cost-benefit analysis that might include the time value of money or the missed opportunity if we fail to fund a project when it's originally programmed because it costs more than we hoped it would or something like that. It doesn't get into that kind of analysis.
Representative Metza.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And so when we're looking at projects that do have those gaps, would you agree then that we make choices that could potentially put a community or roadway or someone in a position where we aren't putting the safest and best plan forward?
Mr. Davis.
Mr. Chair, I would my thought on that is that we are putting the best plan we can afford to put forward. The agency has made remarkable gains in safety improvements and takes our Towards Zero Death initiative, for example, holds that in very high regard. And so we put the best plan that we can afford to put into the system. We make those investments when and where we can, and where the costs of those improvements outpace our ability to pay for them, well, we have to make choices.
Representative Metza.
Last question, Mr. Chair. Thank you.
No problem.
So basically what I'm hearing is if we can't afford it, even though we have all these goals, we will make decisions based on a budget above all else.
Mr. Davis.
Mr. Chair, I don't believe that budget is the only factor that informs the decision. It is a factor, however. And assigning the budget of set aside for a particular project the highest priority is not a practice that I think is common in the agency.
Thank you. Representative Benson.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. We've had a lot of conversation around corridors of commerce, and you know, we started that process and money's been allocated. And I'm wondering, when you talk about the additional $7 billion, is embedded within that $7 billion, I hate to call it a wish list, but is within that $7 billion, are there projects similar to the corridors of commerce and finishing Highway 14? I know this, you know, we're talking a high level here, but can you get a little bit more specific on how that would additional money would help resolve some of those things also?
Mr. Davis.
Mr. Chairman, and thank you for the question. The Transportation Finance Advisory Committee did consider what we refer to as an illustrative list of projects that, but for insufficient funds, we would build as part of our vision for a comprehensive transportation system. And so they do include capacity development or capacity improvements in what we refer to as our interregional corridor system. Trunk Highway 14, for example, is on that system. And so some of these kinds of improvements that communities are looking for or hope that the agency will plan and program for in the near future are included in the $7 billion, but it's what we call an illustrative list. It's not by necessity all things we could build.
Okay, nothing like a little mention of Highway 14 to get the committee excited. Representative Johnson.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And it relates, I'm picking up on Representative Benson, because and going back to the return on investment. We've heard time and again, and I believe you heard in New Ulm maybe, I don't know if you were there that day, but New Ulm makes, I think, a compelling case that they are unable to attract some industry, some business, because of a lack of a four-lane highway. Okay? That's a cost, it seems to me. How does that How is that quantified in the return on investment figures or the cost-benefit ratios that you're working with here?
Proceed.
Mr. Chair, thank you for the question. Those kinds of opportunity costs are not quantified in this study.
Okay. I'm sorry, I was a member. I had something to say here. Are there any other questions from the committee on this particular slide? Okay. So, Mr. Davis, take up where you left off. We have, as you know, I think this is your first appearance, perhaps, in the this year on our committee. We have an active committee that likes to ask good questions. So.
That's correct, Mr. Chairman. I read somewhere that a good chief of staff has a passion for anonymity, and I've tried to make that true about my performance in the role, but it was unavoidable today. So,
okay.
But thank you for the invitation. And so what I wanted to share with the committee was that we took the TFAC investment categories, and there are also 10 categories that we classify investments under the MINSHIP plan, the Minnesota State Highway Investment Plan. And we broke them into 10 return on investment categories. So the study looked at the return on investment for spot improvements and high-risk locations, pavement preservation projects, pavement reconstruction projects on corridors, pavement reconstruction projects on urban or main streets, bridge repairs, bridge replacements, congestion mitigation general, which I'll describe here in more detail in a minute, but it essentially looks at things we can do within the existing right-of-way, or they're very small projects like repairs or reconfigurations of an interchange or an intersection or turn lanes or new striping, things of that nature. Capacity development, which would be actual new lanes for traffic. Active traffic management, which are technologies that we apply in the roadway, principally here in the metropolitan area, that do things like speed harmonization or traffic cameras that help us better manage the congestion on the system. And lastly, the MinPass system. And then in terms of the empirical data that was used to calculate the return on investment, we looked at sample MnDOT projects. And the Smart Growth America folks also brought into the study the results of national studies that they participated in or have access to and best practices to determine the ranges of ROI for each category. So here's what we find, and there's no surprise here. I think you've heard Commissioner Zelli testify to this committee that there is a business case for making these kinds of investments. The investments that would be necessary to maintain the current performance and avoid the consequences of neglecting the system involve investing an additional $5 billion over 20 years, and they are estimated to yield $10 billion to $23 billion in benefits, yielding an average return on investment of 3.1. And a little later in my presentation, I'll share with you some of the ranges so you get a little more detail about that, but that's an average. And then the additional $7 billion on top of the $5 billion for a total of $12 billion would yield an additional $15 billion to $19 billion in benefits, or a return on investment estimated a factor of 2.1. So in total, $12 billion yields $31 billion in benefits, an ROI of 2.5, or stated another way, for every $1 that we invest in the state of Minnesota in the transportation system, we should expect $2.50 in quantifiable benefits.
Before you proceed, Mr. Davis, Representative Benson.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. So if I do my math and we invest the $12 billion over 20 years, that's about $600 million. I guess, we've already heard we have had a presentation by the chairs of the House and the Senate regarding a transportation bill that includes a lot of things. I'm really interested in understanding that, and I didn't hear it. I just want it for the record. Some clarification regarding, we spend the $600 million a year, rough math, if you want to just divide it equally. There's nothing in these calculations in regards to how additions to light rail or passenger rail would impact. This is specifically the thing that is near and dearest to my heart, roads and bridges, and the economic benefit by roads and bridges and cars and trucks to the state based on this investment with no consideration to what may additionally happen to the other. And I'm getting a nod, but I'll let you answer yes. And what for our members here in the committee is that what we've heard in a prior presentation is that there is a competing that will be competing for these same funds would be any expansion of any light rail or other kind of if we were to try to do both, we're looking at a really substantial investment. And for me at least, and I'll let you answer if I got that correct, that this should be our priority. This is where the money should be going to. I don't disagree. I'm just so thankful. Chair Hornish, not Hornish, Hornstein, you must, we'll take Cornish with a gun too. You may have.
Combination of me and Tony Cornish.
He must have pulled out the.
Personality.
He must have done something with.
Hornish.
The St. Paul, something in St. Paul because they filled all the potholes on Rice Street. Thank you so much for your influence there. Just to get back to it, really, I mean, we need to make this investment. I understand that. And I love roads and bridges, so if I could convince the chairman that this would be our emphasis. But can you add, or just yay or nay, I think I saw your head nodding.
Mr. Chair and Representative Benson, thank you for the question, and thank you for your support for roads and bridges. We love roads and bridges also. It is true this study does not, it is the $12 billion gap that I'm testifying about today is exclusively a gap for state investment in state roads and bridges. So it does not include transit investments or other modes, nor does it include improvements necessary for other systems like local systems, city and county systems, or ports or rail. I know that my boss, Commissioner Zale, would want me to testify today, and so I will take the opportunity that we at MnDOT appreciate that this is a system that has some symbiotic nature, that they complement one another, and that the improvements that are investments that are made in the trunk highway system alone without corresponding investments in other modes may not yield these benefits. So there's some... what I mean to testify there is that Commissioner Zale recognizes and the department by extension recognizes that these systems complement one another. They work together to get the results, and that investment in one system at the neglect of another doesn't necessarily yield the benefits that are here. But set that aside, directly to your question, this study does not include or take any analysis of transit investments or rail investments or any other modes.
Follow up.
Okay, Benson.
But what I did hear is before the but was what I did hear is that the return on investment may not happen unless there's this symbiotic relationship. So did I hear you correctly in saying that we need the build out of those additional things to even realize this the cost benefit that you're here to present with us today?
Mr. Chairman and Representative Benson, thank you for the opportunity to clarify. What I mean to say is that congestion in the Twin Cities, just for an example, anticipate another 1 million people. Without transit investments, those folks are going to be presumably using cars, perhaps driving alone, operating a system and putting conditional strain on it. And so these kind of investments, these sort of congestion improvements assume that these kind of systems are going to be operating. However, there's nothing in the study that would lead one to conclude that the benefits depend on additional investments in other systems in order to get these kinds of benefits.
Thank you. Representative Dean, followed by Representative Bernardi.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. My question is about that congestion and about the system build-out in transportation, light rails. When I look at the projects with the highest ROIs, it calls out congestion mitigation in general at 5.5. So my question to you would be, how would that number be affected if we did no more investment in the metro area transit system? Would it go up? Would it go down? And when you mention the million people, does this consider that, and as I think that Representative Benson is getting, is does the transit play a factor in some of these numbers, whether or not you were evaluating that transit component in and of itself?
Mr. Chair, Representative, the congestion mitigation general, the types of projects that are included in that are projects that are in our existing right-of-way. When we look at bottlenecks that we attribute to things like intersections that operate less than optimum, where a turn lane would make a difference, where a grade-separated intersection would make a difference so the traffic could flow better. And those kinds of projects look at those things independently of transit investments and yield the conclusion that they would return a 5.5 return on investment.
Right, Representative Bernardi.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, and welcome to the committee, Mr. Davis. I have a question. When you're talking about other modes, I think it's important that we have be clear what modes are you talking about being handled on the trunk highway system. And we, you know what you're saying, not transit, not rail. Can you be clear on what it means for trunk highways?
Mr. Davis.
Mr. Chair, Representative Bernardi, so the transit system does operate on trunk highways, and so with improvements in trunk highways have a corresponding positive impact on transit.
Right.
And so it's very difficult, I think, to separate them because the separation is somewhat artificial to what's happening in the real system. Setting that aside, the study scope looked exclusively at projects on the trunk highway system.
Okay. Follow up, Mr. Chair.
Sure.
Okay, thank you. Okay, Mr. Davis, so that I just, what I'm, it's kind of a leading question, I'm guessing, but I really wanted the answer, and I wasn't trying to, like, I'm not trying to, like, set you up for this, but it does include, MnDOT's responsibility on trunk highways does include the modes of moving cars, the modes of people, pedestrians, and people biking. That's part of the trunk highway system. That's what I'm trying to get at. Okay.
Mr. Chair, Representative Bernardi, that is correct, yes.
Thank you.
Okay. Thank you. So we're moving into, I think, our summary here. Oh, Representative Beard, of course.
Thank you. This is a good committee question, so I'm glad the Vice Chair set this up. The other modes that we've made you responsible for, like walking and biking and things, on the trunk highway system, how are they paid for?
Mr. Chair, Representative Beard, thank you for the question. There are, in our investment categories, our midship system, we set aside investments or categories for pedestrian and bicycle improvements as a percentage of the total amount that we have to invest in the system in a given year. And so in the state highway plan, there are what we call their trunk highway eligible projects, usually paid for when we do a pavement project on a given area. We'll make improvements to the pedestrian or bicycle facilities in that area. Some of our Main Street enhancement projects are some of the best illustration of that.
Representative Beard.
Madam Chair, I think he was dancing around I'll just ask him by blank. Trunk highway funds are to be spent on roads and bridges, not the accoutrements that go with. They can go with local projects, and we're glad to have that happen. So we're not spending trunk highway dollars building pedestrian walkways or bike paths and things like that. Can you be clear with that?
Mr. Chairman,
are we?
If it's within the scope of a trunk highway project, though, I don't mean to dance around it. We're not using trunk highway funds to build a bicycle facility that's not part of a trunk highway system or project. If I'm getting at your question, and perhaps I'm still not understanding it.
Kind of, if it's part of the process. Okay, Mr. Chairman, I just wanted to raise the issue because it's one that we have some discussions about constitutionally and so on. I remember the Complete Streets discussion here a few years ago about having MnDOT accommodate these requests within the scope of a project certainly makes a lot of common sense, but the rub gets to be where the dollars come from to pay for it, and that's something we should be pretty cautious of. And so I'm hearing that we accommodate them, and I wouldn't be surprised if there was some leakage from the Trunk Highway Fund. You know there's holes all over that bucket, Mr. Chair. this is probably one of them that we should be paying attention to going forward. So we can accommodate it when the project's happening, but just that the Trunk Highway dollars are actually building the infrastructure for other modes is one that some of us have a great deal of concern about.
Okay, thank you. Vice Chair Bernardi.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. That it might, it's kind of been an urban legend that trunk highway money can't be spent on facilities for the trunk highway, as in biking and walking and cars. It's just limited to cars. There's been a study that was just done recently that by William Mitchell Law Center that kind of debunks that urban legend. So it might be helpful for us at some time to have a common understanding among us what can the funding be used for.
I think Representative Bernardi and Representative Beard are in agreement on this. Representative Houseman.
And Mr. Chair, I would just follow up a little bit. Just coincidentally, this week had two people communicate with me from my district because, of course, you know, a street like Snelling is also a highway that MnDOT has responsibility for. And so one of the letters came from a mother whose son goes to school, I think Falcon Heights Elementary on Garden Street. I think that's the one it was. And she asked me, and she specifically cited the Snelling-Larpenter intersection. And so she said, how can my son get safely across that intersection on his bike? Because she thought he ought to be able to bike to school. They live close enough. And so I think what we're struggling with here is when you work on Snelling, which you just did, is that a question you have to ask? How is a little boy on a bike safely going to get across this intersection?
Mr. King. I'm sorry, Mr. Davis.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Representative Houseman, our complete streets policy compels us to ask or investigate those kinds of questions within the scope of projects that we're going to do in a given corridor or something on our system, including links like Snelling. I'm not prepared to answer your question about what specifically we concluded about the project in the metropolitan area, that specific project. But I can testify that our policy compels us to at least examine the question.
And then, Mr. Chair, just the other person was the hospitality person, the visitor person from Roseville, and they, knowing that lots of people want to bike these days, and so what do they do about it? So they thought they'd check on the Nice Ride, the green bikes at Rosedale. Mm-hmm. And they were told by Nice Ride, is it Nice Ride?
Mm-hmm. Yes.
They were told by them they wouldn't put bikes there because Roseville was built as an automobile city. Mm-hmm. I mean, it's just, that's the biking entity just saying, here's a suburb, it's just for cars. I mean, it's just sort of that was a surprising thing for all of us, I think, to say, well, there's some limitations for all of those people who want some transportation choices.
Well, this is a little bit of a warm-up maybe for our debate next week. So, okay, so members, I think we're almost, Mr. Davis is ready to summarize, and then we'll take a couple more questions, and it does look like we are going to stick around for Representative Earhart's bill. There is a fiscal note. So,
okay, thank you, Mr. Chair. I'll be brief. I did bring with you a chart that I think any seasoned PowerPoint presenter would say you should never bring, and I did it anyway. But I wanted to just give you a sense of what were the sources of data for these findings, what went into it, and here's a chart that summarizes that briefly. And the chart that follows it gives you a sense of what kinds of investments would this be. How would what we roughly refer to as $12 billion, it's actually specified here as $12.5 billion investments, how would they break out across these categories? And what is the range associated with return on investment? Because some projects are estimated to have a high return, while others are estimated to have a low return. And that's attributable to a wide range of factors. There are some links in our system that may no longer generate the benefits we anticipated when we originally built them. Capital costs are naturally high. The projects that have lower capital costs to build understandably have a higher ROI with such a simple division. So with that, Mr. Chair, I'll conclude my remarks, and unless there are any other questions, so okay. Thank you for the time.
Thank you. I just want to also at this point mention that we had a note from the Chamber of Commerce, and it would be maybe helpful to clarify, Mr. Davis, apparently the Chamber was not didn't participate in the development of this or endorse the report's conclusions. Is that, can you clarify that? That's my understanding from the chamber.
Mr. Chair, my understanding was that the project was funded by the McKnight Foundation, that the chamber helped sponsor that, but I may okay. have
well,
be incorrect about that.
I think that the issue may be that I know the Minneapolis Chamber has been involved in some of this work, but probably not the state chamber. But we'll get some clarity on that, perhaps.
Yes. Yes, thank you.
Okay. Representative O'Neill, Representative Mason.
Thank you, Chair. Looking at the active traffic management ROI, since it's so high, can you just help me understand how that would manifest itself outside of the urban core? What exactly would that be outside of our urban core?
Mr. Chair, Representative O'Neill, active traffic management operates within the metropolitan area. So these are investments in signs like that help, like on I-94, where we give cues to people to try to harmonize speed. We use ramp meters to control the flow of access to the main interstates. These projects do not operate in Greater Minnesota. There are technologies similar to active traffic management that operate in Greater Minnesota, but those projects are classified as safety spot improvements, and they're things like our rural intersection warning systems. So there are similar technologies found in Greater Minnesota, but these projects are exclusively metropolitan projects.
Representative O'Neill, sure.
Thank you, Chair. So a dynamic shoulder or a managed lane, is that considered the active traffic management as well? Or?
Mr. Chair, Representative O'Neill, using a hardened shoulder, using a shoulder with a lane that we can control above, like a signal that allows us to use it during certain times, is an example of the kind of investment. So,
Representative O'Neill.
Thank you, so, Chair. So my question would be then, if that's not really considered viable outside of the urban core, then we had another presentation, again, about I-94, going outside of the urban core when we're, you know, getting out into Wright County and so on, which hopefully we're not considering that urban core because I go through a lot of farm fields on my way home. Why are we considering doing managed lanes on I-94 after we get outside of the urban core?
Mr. Davis.
And Mr. Chair, Representative O'Neill, when we look at our managed lane study, and I'm familiar only to this extent, that the Metropolitan Council and the Metropolitan Planning Organization wants to study the feasibility of a managed lane from, I think, Albertville to the airport. And so there's the boundaries of the planning organization and MnDOT's district boundaries are not precisely the same. And so we would look at the feasibility or the planning organization would like us to look at the feasibility of that kind of a system all the way out, I believe, to Albertville. And I can clarify that and make sure the committee has the, more precise answer.
Thank you, Chair. Yes, I would like that because that was a discussion of why do we need managed lanes past even Rogers. That would be a great help to me to understand because once you get past Albertville, I can't imagine how a managed lane would be helpful considering there isn't transit going down that corridor from that point.
Mr. Chair, members of the committee, I'd be happy to get back to the committee about the details about the scope of that study.
That'd be wonderful. I appreciate that. Thank you.
Thank you. And then we'll have our last question from Representative Mason.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, Mr. Davis. This has been very helpful. And I think I understand what you're doing here and probably why you did it. But one question I have, especially since there's been another major accident on Highway 14, and within the study here it mentions that you can measure congestion mitigation, and yet when I'm thinking of all the expense that is involved in a fatal accident with the number of people involved and also all the ramifications of the emergency vehicles, etc., dealing with those accidents, and it happens fairly regularly, that to me seems like an incredible amount of money. So how do we go about including some of that within the study? Or it's something that I think we need to be taking into consideration as well.
Mr. Chair and Representative, thank you for the question. First, just a quick comment that one life lost on our system is too many, and we have our Towards Zero Death program as testimony to that. And the study does attempt to quantify the consequences and costs associated with crashes and lost lives and injuries on our system. And I've committed to the committee to get you some precise data about that, and we'll do so. And so it is factored in. Again, the study is forward-facing and is somewhat speculative about what kinds of injuries we might see on the system. But to the extent that we factor those sort of benefits in when we calculate the return on investment on a project, it is a factor that's considered.
Thank you.
So thank you. So it sounds like there, and I really appreciate, Mr. Davis, your time and organizing this presentation. And members, as this came up in the conversation with Representative Benson, we talked about ROI for transit last year, and now we have this study. So even though they're different entities, last year was a business group, the Itasca project, and of course MnDOT is a public sector perspective. But either way, it's important to sort of see what we're getting in return for the dollars we spend on transportation. I think this is a good study, and I really appreciate MnDOT doing it and reporting back to us about it. So thank you. So our staff did quite a bit of quick work with this fiscal note. It is an official one. And speaking of staff, our wonderful new committee legislative assistant is celebrating a birthday today. So if you have a chance to wish Isaiah a happy birthday, do that. You know, when you get to his age, you don't really want to announce how old he is. So,
Chairman, aren't birthday folks supposed to bring treats when they come?
No, I think we're supposed to bring treats for them. So, no. Anyway, so happy birthday, Isaiah.
I think the chair is kicking us all up for lunch.
That may be coming later. We have one bill before us, and members, this is House File 1796. As you'll recall, yesterday we heard the bill. I have not forgotten that Representative Holberg and Representative Dean had questions yesterday. So we're going to get to those. But we heard this bill. We did not act on it because there was no fiscal note. So we have a fiscal note, and I believe in response to the fiscal note, there's an amendment. So that's being passed out. Representative Earhart, just take us home here. There seems like there's a lot going on here. So what did you have in mind? And Mr. Werke, welcome back.
Mr. Chair, as they get sitting there, can we approve the minutes?
Yes, that's
the
a
minutes
great idea.
For looking at the date here, and it's not popping up. Okay, sorry, 312, sorry, March 12th.
Okay, yesterday's minutes. Thank you, Representative Bernardi moves yesterday's minutes from March 12th. All those in favor signify by saying aye.
Aye.
All those opposed, the motion carries. So we now have, we're continuing our hearing on House File 1796. Would the committee, Representative Dean, Representative Holberg, would you like to ask your questions now that you had on your mind yesterday, or do you want to wait till this fiscal note and amendment situation is sorted out? I know that both of you had questions, so I want to make sure we get to those. Okay, Representative Dean.
Mr. Chair, I'd like to actually ask mine now, because as we get into the fiscal note and other things, my question will probably become somewhat irrelevant.
Okay. Proceed.
Mr. Chair and Representative Earhart, the article that you passed around yesterday concerning driving while on cell phones was, to me, very troubling and very scary. And I know that your bill looks at directly increasing fines and those types of natures for people on their phones while they are going through a construction zone. Have you given any thought to carrying a bill that would be farther and actually ban the use of cell phones while driving in Minnesota?
Representative Earhart.
Mr. Chairman, I think I quoted from one study that said how many states do that now. and I'm looking for it if I can find it. I think it says that handheld cell phones use 12 states, District Columbia, Puerto Rico, Guam, and the U.S. Virgin Islands prohibit all drivers from using handheld cell phones while driving. And there are 37 states in D.C. ban all cell phone use by novice drivers. So there is a movement in that direction. I don't think we've killed enough people or scared enough people yet so that we're ready to consider that. And normally the way it goes, Minnesota is the last one to take any kind of precautionary notice. We were the last state in the United States to acquire the use of seatbelts. So maybe we have to start with where we see a real clear and present danger, and that is where work zone workers are endangered, and work towards something broader.
Representative Beard, and then I think we're just going to move on because this could really evolve into quite a discussion. So
it certainly will, Mr. Chair, but just the comment about seatbelts in .08, I'd like to point out to Chair Earhart that had the federal government not used their heavy hand to mandate Minnesota do this, we probably would have done it years ago. But I think some of the reluctance and resistance was just sort of that a sovereignty issue about a Congress mandating that we do things and conform to stuff that maybe we didn't think up first. Like I say, had the feds not come out with their club and forced us all into a corner, we probably would have passed it 15 years ago. But just because I think we had to make a statement, I think that's why we didn't. We had it. We just had to comply with federal stuff. So,
Mr. Chairman, I think it's the other side of the coin which says, you're not going to tell me what to do. I get the feeling that that's kind of maybe more the attitude.
I think it, Representative Earhart is... what is that, Representative Beard? I'm sorry.
I asked for it.
No, I think Representative Earhart may be expressing what I think is common on some of these traffic safety issues in the legislature, is that there is a libertarian piece that we have, which is... You know, I'm not commenting one way or the other, but on this kinds of issues, it comes up in the cell phone, it comes up in the seatbelt issue. It's not partisan. I know that Democrats in some parts of the state feel very strongly about opposing these kinds of things, and so, you know, as do some Republicans. So this is a vexing issue. I think it does have to do more with that little libertarian streak that we have, I think, in Minnesota on some of these issues. Maybe that's what Representative Earhart was.
Well, Mr. Chairman, it could be that there are too many stubborn Norwegians here, too.
Okay, let's get to the bill. I will say, Representative Dean, that last year, or maybe a year and a half ago, the National Transportation Safety Board came out with a conclusion that we should be looking at this these cell phone bans, and I then went on public radio, I believe, a call-in show, and you wouldn't really believe it was public radio based on the, some of the comments that I got. So even public radio listeners are feel strongly in opposition to this, so some at least. So anyway, so I agree with you. I hope we can move forward. You're absolutely right. This is the equivalent of .08. Handheld and no hands-free are both bad. So I wanted to say that on the record. But to the bill.
Well, I don't know where we were, Mr. Chairman.
We were.
The third or fourth time we've been here, but we got cut off because we ran out of time.
Representative Earhart, we had heard your bill.
Yes.
There was a fiscal note.
Yes.
Being developed. We didn't have the fiscal note, and we have it now. So we are ready to act on your bill unless there's any questions of the committee. There's also an HRD1 amendment that was passed out. So, you know, you can explain the amendment. If there's questions from the committee about the bill, let's get those out of the way first.
And Mr. Chair, I'm still needing to ask a question of MnDOT whenever you
absolutely.
Feel
let's do that now.
And Mr. Chair and Representative Earhart, I'm glad you didn't make note of the demeanor of Germans and whether or not they were stubborn or not. Because, of course, we're not.
Ma'am, sir, I
would argue with you on that.
Representative Holberg, I know about that.
Mr. Chair, my concern is just in how this this changing dynamic of different speed limits and laws in effect when workers are present or not. And in many discussions on the MnPass issue, there's a belief expressed by MnDOT that drivers need continuity and need to know what to expect and that we can't change things on a day-to-day basis. And so in the context of MnDOT's position and concerns about MnPass, why in the case of work zones where, in fact, these standards may even change due to the weather, and you know, you could have guys out working and a torrential rain comes in with no expectation, change the constraints or standards within that work zone. And I'm wondering why the difference in policy.
Welcome to the committee. Please state your name for the record and respond, please.
My name is Peter Buchan. I'm the Assistant State Traffic Engineer with the Minnesota Department of Transportation. I also have with me Ken Johnson, who is the State Work Zone Safety Engineer.
And to Representative Holberg's question.
Okay. Chair and Representative Holberg, I think the main difference that I would point out is that a construction environment is often constantly changing. And whereas your daily commute is more predictable from day to day in a construction zone, things could change, and equipment and workers and workspaces can change, and that's why there's more flexibility in when works and when the speed limit's established and where it's established is the nature of the work.
And Mr. Chair, I don't know that I agree with that assessment, the changing dynamics of a commute and car accidents, et cetera, I think have some of the same characteristics of unpredictability. But talk to me about the type of sign and how you're going to manage the signing in this work zone process so that drivers will be well informed of the changing dynamics of the standards in the work zone.
Chair and Representative, I'd like Ken to address that. He's more familiar with the work zone setups. He's the expert in that.
Mr. Johnson, I believe.
Mr. Chair, Representative Holberg.
Oh, please state your name for the record.
My name is Ken Johnson. Yep. I'm the State Work Zone Engineer with the Minnesota Department of Transportation. And regarding work zone setups, we actually do have standards that we have that are well known. We train all of the work zone providers, all the temporary traffic control providers, on how to set up appropriate speed limits in work zones. We do require that there is advance notification if the speed limit gets reduced a fair amount, but at 50 miles an hour or beyond, we do advance notification of that. We put up signs at the locations where we do want the drivers to slow down, and we do notify drivers at the end of the work zone where that speed limit is in effect.
Well, Mr. Chair, I'm actually quite familiar about traffic signs and standards and training. What I'm asking you is, how are you going to address the dynamic nature? In other words, when you need the mile or so notice of reduced speed ahead or turn off your cell phone or whatever the case may be, how will these signs change whether there's workers in the work zone or not, or will they be signs that will be put up for the duration of the project that will say, if you see workers, hang up your phone and slow down more, or how is this going to work?
Mr. Johnson.
Mr. Chair, Representative Holberg, I anticipate that what we would be doing is putting up regulatory signs regarding the cell phone use. We don't have a design for that yet because this would be a new statutory requirement. But we would put up a regulatory sign that says no cell phone use while within the work zone, something of that nature. So, because that's a new one. Regarding the workers' present speed limit, or the work zone speed limit, we have historically been doing, we've had something similar on the books for a while. And what we've been doing with that is we have had it, the speed limit sign set up, the existing speed limit covered, when the workers are present. And when they are not doing their work, the signs are supposed to be turned away and the existing speed limit sign is uncovered. We've been having some issues with that on making sure that that is getting done. So we are working on a new, we're calling it electronic work zone speed limit, where we will have, and we've used this on a couple of projects over the past couple of years, where there is a sign with an LED display on it that will change based on the location of workers. There are a couple different designs out there. One could use a handheld device to make the necessary change, but and we're looking at other ways to do it too, whether it's automatically turned on when a worker is present. We would have to put tags on people in order to do that. I hesitate to do that, but we would use an iPad or a tablet in order to control the change, and the contractor would be required to do that. They would change the speed limit when workers are present, and when workers are not in that particular area, they would change the speed limit back to what it was prior to that time.
And Mr. Chair, if I might, could those signs include both message points, i.e. no cell phone and the lower speed limit at the same time? And then in preparing your fiscal note, what type of signage do you use for the monetary assumptions in the fiscal note?
Mr. Johnson?
Mr. Chair, Representative Holberg, we use the current method of setting up speed limit signs and then taking them down when we did that initial assumption. We don't have enough information yet for the electronic workers' present speed limit in order to come up with what that would cost. It's a new method that we're using at this point. The initial cost with that would likely be high, but it would drop as time goes on when the contractors get those signs. And then we would be in a construction project where they're being used, we would rent the use of them. So when we came up with that, the values on there, we were using the standard way of doing it. But I think it would be relatively similar because we're offsetting the cost of labor for setting up the signs, taking them down, exposure for workers as they're putting up the sign, we're offsetting that with the cost for the electronic components of those other speed limit signs. We don't, again, with the no cell phone use in work zones, we could try a couple of different things. We have a way that we can ask the public. We've got a method of asking the public what can be effective. We have a way of going through the online community. There's a group that we can ask what can be effective with them. We would likely do some studies in order to determine whether a regulatory sign would work more effectively than a changeable message sign, but we will be looking at different options for the no cell phone use within work zones.
Well, Mr. Chair,
Representative Holberg,
I think it's important that the no cell phone use sign be dynamic as well, because it's impossible to know whether or not it's an active work zone until you actually encounter the worker. And in many instances, the lane restriction may be a mile, two, or three, where you're actually in a work zone, but you don't actually see the workers. I think of the work that was done north of St. Paul on 35E a couple summers ago. Those were long, single lane work zone areas, but you would not even know that there was a worker in the work zone. For if you were going slowly, you could be on a 10-15 minute conversation and not encounter the workers yet. And I'm concerned that we can't be in a position where people don't have an awareness of what the regulation is and aren't able to react appropriately. And so I would really challenge the department that I think that the electronic or dynamic signing of the changing speed limit is important, but that that design should also be able to reflect both messages, the changing speed limit and the cell phone use prohibition, prior to entering the work zone, so that drivers have a fair chance of complying with the law when the workers aren't present at the very beginning of the work zone.
Thank you. I have four people on the list. We have an amendment, and then I'd like to also get to a vote. Representative Metza, Representative O'Neill, Representative Howe, Representative Beard.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I guess I had last year sold my Ford Excursion because it didn't fit in the SOB parking lot too well, and upgraded to a Buick Verona. Whether people agree with the upgrade or not, it's a different question, but I did get the hands-free calling with the car, and my car does have a number that people can call in separate from my cell phone, and I was wondering if this would apply to anyone with an OnStar service or any other types of hands-free services from, or would the same law apply to them?
Representative Earhart.
Mr. Chairman, Representative Metza, we have calculated the incarceration rate depend on a progressive basis. So the more expensive a car, we expect that you're in that bracket and we're going to hit you twice as hard. I don't think there's an answer to that, and I don't know if we have there are some didn't we talk about that where the device is built into the car?
Yep, Mr. Chair, clarification is
on
not
line
a mobile
page
device.
619, I think, in the bill, page 6, line 19, I think that's addressed. So it sounds like it would apply to both your car and the traditional handheld.
I don't even know if I got a copy of the bill anymore.
Is that, I don't think, so that, I just clarified that, Representative Earhart, for the committee. Representative O'Neill, followed by Representative Howe.
Thank you, Chair. Further clarification on that, I guess, so I have GPS on my phone because I don't have a separate Garmin or whatever, so am I allowed to use my cell phone to navigate myself through, or do I have to turn my cell phone off and then reactivate my map program, which actually is more dangerous than just leaving it on and listening to the voice activated. You know, this.
Well,
what am I allowed to do or not allowed to do with this?
Mr. Chairman, I think we're just talking about cell phones, handheld or hands-free. So if you have a device built into the car, I thought we were saying we're not tampering with that.
Representative O'Neill.
Thank you. So just clarification, I use my phone like I would a Garmin or a TomTom or, what, you know, nobody uses those anymore. Everyone pretty much uses their cell phone to navigate themselves through traffic. And, you know, I use it for a lot of different things and to get to destinations, to navigate around traffic issues and things like that. I use it every single day, even though I know where I'm going, because sometimes, especially on 94, I'll say that again, I-94, there's terrible traffic. So would I be allowed to continue to use my cell phone as a navigation device or not with this legislation?
Mr. Chairman and Representative, what we're trying to do is keep you from getting killed, so or kill a work zone worker. And so we don't want you looking at that when you're, that's a cell phone, and you're using it for another purpose than calling people, but you're using it. So I think we're saying that put it down, and you're not going to have to worry about going through a well-marked work zone and weaving your way through traffic like you seem to indicate.
Chair, so, but what does it actually say in the legislation, though? So is that an exemption? Can you use your phone? Can you not use your phone
it for says,
a navigation device?
Mr. No? Chairman.
Representative Earhart.
Chair, so, but what does it actually say in the legislation, though? So is that an exemption? Can you use your phone? Can you not use your phone
it
for
says,
a navigation device?
Mr.
No?
Chairman.
Representative Earhart.
On page 6 of the bill, 6.17. Prohibit on use work zones.
So, if I could just interpret here, Representative O'Neill, from my reading of the legislation, you would be prohibited from using your cell phone as a GPS device. It seems like a pretty a blanket prohibition on cell phone use in the work zone itself.
Yeah.
So that means I'd have to turn the cell phone off lose my, and then you have to reprogram it in and then bring it back. I mean, that's more dangerous than just letting it sit in my holder and just listening to it as I go through. As you know what I'm saying? So I think this is this is fairly problematic.
Mr. Burris, you know, and again, I think the committee, I always have to demonstrate for the committee. See, a lot of this I don't really know about, but so this is all new to me. But Mr. Burris, I think this is where we have to phone a friend, not using a cell phone in a work zone. I imagine if it's on, maybe it could be kept on but not used. Perhaps is that where we're going with this in the bill? What is your interpretation of this, Mr. Burris?
Mr. Chair and members, I think there are a couple of possible interpretations. Ultimately, just to set the context a little bit, it would probably come down to a court case and how the courts would interpret the provision. So my reading, which is just my reading, is I think it's the reasonable that a court would take a look at the context where this provision is being put in, which is into a statute that already bans wireless communications. And part of that ban specifically excludes global positioning devices or devices being used for GPS purposes from the ban. And also in the context of the current law where this prohibition is going into effect, most of the prohibition is around that currently exists is fairly comprehensive around using, reading, receiving, kind of actively getting data from using a wireless communications device, which is a pretty broad definition. And I guess that's a long-winded way of saying I think a court could reasonably view cellular phone use as talking on a phone, so voice communications with the cellular phone.
And I think Mr. Burris is referring to the statute we passed a few years back on no texting while driving, correct?
Mr. Chair, yes. This the ban being proposed in the bill is another subdivision in that same statute.
Okay. So, members, we'll try to move this along, but I want to make sure these are important questions, so we'll get to all of them. Hal Beard and now Representative Mason. Representative Hal.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, but Representative O'Neill asked the question I was thinking of, but now it just expands the fact that what constitutes a cell phone? Can I use my iPad? Can I use my laptop? I mean, because all those devices can now be used as those electronic it just opens up another Pandora's box. Where we go with this thing.
If I don't answer this correctly, thank you, Representative Howell. If I don't answer this correctly, I'll definitely have Mr. Burris amplify. But since I was the author of that, so and we did those devices that you're describing, Representative Howell, would be prohibited in that statute, correct, Mr. Burris?
Yeah.
And the no texting, we didn't, like computers and iPads, those would be covered under the no texting provision. Is that correct?
Mr. Chair, members, yes, the no texting provision was very broad, established a new wireless communications device category in statute. So there's a statutory definition of that. There's also a statutory definition of cellular phone that has been in place for a number of years, and that refers to, part of that definition covers various types of telephones that are capable of sending or receiving telephone or text messages without an access line for service.
No Skyping while driving. Okay. All right. We're almost nearing the end of our list. Representative Beard followed by Representative Mason.
Well, Mr. Chair, this has been a fascinating dynamic discussion. I'm trying to remember what my burning question was at the moment, except I remember it was process. But I do have a couple other ones. We have House File 1796 in front of us. It doesn't say anything about what engrossment it is. Is this the one we amended the other day that took out the photo provisions? Oh, here it is. I'm sorry. It does say first engrossment up there. I did not look high enough on the page. Mr. Chair, there's also an A7 amendment. Did we adopt that area? Are we intending to? Are we going to work from that?
I think that was that was incorporated at the beginning of the hearing yesterday, I believe.
Yesterday? Okay,
yesterday,
thank you. That's helpful for this member to know. And then we're going to consider the D1 because of the fiscal note eventually.
Correct.
Okay.
And then we'll do that right after Representative Mason's question.
Okay. Back to the a couple quick questions this issue. Just to be clear, I like where we're going with the signage, the dynamic signage that, because we have work zones that are 10 or 12 miles long sometimes, construction zone, where the actual work might only be happening at milepost 7 or something. Having the dynamic signage is going to be very helpful to the motoring public. And I think Representative Holberg raised some good points that I hope MnDOT is listening to. And particularly when the patrol gets trained on this, that they're listening to it as well, that they know what we're looking for. So if somebody's in a construction zone and they're looking at their GPS or they're taking a call from the babysitter, we're good. But when we actually get to the flashing lights or people are actually doing work, the construction zone then, workers present, that's a different issue. And then there's that's a statement, just for the record, so that patrol and MnDOT hears what the will of the committee is. Because we're going to take a step here. It's the nose of the aircraft carrier under the tent, Mr. Chair. but it seems to be reasonable that we start, if the real goal is to save lives in work zones where people are actually working, there's a couple ways to go about it. One is to make the penalties for actually hurting somebody so onerous that it gets people's attention, they pay attention. What we're doing with this is we're picking out a certain behavior and we're saying, this one seems to be problematic, even though I don't know we have exactly empirical evidence that it's happening, but it seems to be what we're going to do now. So if that's going to be the case, then we want to be very clear what it is we're penalizing people for and that the citizens know that. Last question that's kind of related, but I want to be clear about the flagger portion. We do have some language on paragraph 3 about a flagger. If something happens outside of that delineated zone with the flashing lights or the new billboards and the flagger steps up, sometimes flaggers pop up because somebody's turning a truck around on a highway and there's a gap in traffic and they may back into an active lane that the drivers are using. Does that mean, can you define whether that all of a sudden immediately becomes a work zone? I know we got to obey the flagger, but what if I'm talking to Chair Hornstein about an amendment that's coming up and a flagger steps out in front of me, and I have to slam down the phone or put him on hold, or what happens at that point?
Mr. Chair, I am sure Representative Beard would not do that kind of silly driving. You would be a good driver or not. You probably don't talk to your cell phone when you're driving.
Never. Never.
Okay. Representative Beard.
That was my question. Does this apply to the flagger, too? Does the flagger become part of a moving work zone? What's your intention there? And I think it's just important to state that for the record.
Mr. Werke, or which of you would like to respond?
The flagger is generally, Mr. Chairman, in the work zone. I don't know what they're at the start of the work zone. How close do you have to be to the work zone?
Mr. Werke, where is the flagger typically positioned?
Mr. Chairman, members of the committee, for the record, my name is Tim Werke with the Associated General Contractors of Minnesota. I may have to defer to Mr. Burris for this, but I believe we're talking about referring back to the definition of work zone in the beginning of the bill. Mm-hmm. So that's one issue. We're not talking about a situation where a vehicle is backing out of a driveway and someone's out there directing traffic as a flagger to ensure the safety of that movement. So I believe what's intended by this language, it may not be explicit here, is particular projects on low-volume roadways where in order to control the flow of traffic from one end of the project to the other, there is an individual at the project, sometimes at both ends of the project, that is considered a flagger who is controlling traffic. But I think I'd like to defer maybe to Mr. Burris.
Okay, Mr. Burris, and then we're going to have Representative Dean, and then we're going to need to vote soon. So, Mr. Burris. Okay, sure. Representative Dean after Representative Burris, after Mr. Burris. He sometimes is a representative.
Mr. Chair and members, Mr. Werke is correct in pointing out that there's a definition of work zone that's in Section 1 of the bill. So it would narrow the flagger provision to cases where a road authority is doing construction, maintenance, work on the road.
Representative Dean.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, and Representative Earhart. I'm looking at this bill, and I believe that the intent of this bill is to make work zones safer for the individuals, and that we're using enhanced penalties as to make it safe. So the intent of this bill isn't to increase penalties on people. Is that correct?
Representative Earhart.
We are using increased penalties. Is that yes.
But, Mr. Chair, but the intent is to make the work zones safer.
Representative Earhart.
That's correct, Mr. Chairman and Representative Dean. Some states have gone to really big, we're talking 1,000, 10,000, 7,500 for occurrences in work zones. We'd have to change some other laws if we went beyond $300 because I think that's the break point for gross misdemeanor.
Mr. Burris, I think there's a question for you.
So we stopped at 300. We had it higher than that, but then the council said you've gone beyond where we have to change other statutes.
Okay. Representative Mason for the last question, then we'll take on the HRD 1 amendment.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, and it's more of a comment. In 2010, I did have a bill banned cell phones, and so I got a lot of emails and additional support along the way. But the it is my intent to bring it again, but what we're starting to talk about is the distracted driving, which means the bill needs to be enlarged. But by and large, the main problem with the cell phones or anything handheld is, for instance, somebody would drop the phone, they would pick it up, the next thing they're in an accident. And even and now, over the last couple of years, we've got so many things within the car now, but they are still distracted. Distractions from people from driving, and those are the things that we need to really keep in mind. And that's why whatever bill comes forward needs to be very comprehensive.
Thank you. And some of the veterans on the committee will remember that Representative Mike Yaros used to bring these bills to us quite often. Okay.
Mr. Chair, just real quick.
Yes, Representative Holbrook.
Will you, Minda, I think should be, right now you just have flag or ahead signs, and they're real random. Usually they're little cheap little fold-out things. Mm. I mean, I think if with this change of policy, they're going to have to say flag or ahead, no cell phone use.
Sounds like
again, you've got to notify the driving public what the changing standard is before they enter that area.
So sounds reasonable. Okay, Representative Earhart, and then we have to get to your amendment here.
Okay, what we're thinking about is these folks that stand by all of our intersections around here with the sign and says, I'm out of work. We're thinking about changing those signs to something that's more productive. Maybe they put that as a tagline on there, but we say something about orange cones, no cell phones, and so that they understand that we drive that message to the public in a way that it catches your attention before you get on the freeway.
Okay, to the HRD1 amendment. Representative Earhart, did you want to explain the amendment?
Well,
everyone has a copy of it. It's handwritten.
Mr. Burris do that.
Okay. Let's have Mr. Burris explain the amendment, and then you'll move that amendment, Representative Earhart.
Okay. Mr. Chair and members, the fiscal note identified a couple of different areas of costs. In the courts section, the courts identified a general fund cost, and this is due to the reallocation of some of the fine revenue going into the new work zone safety account that's being created in the bill. The amendment would allocate $28,000 annually from this new work zone safety account back to the general fund, which would zero out the general fund cost as the court has identified it.
Questions? Okay. Representative Earhart moves to amend House File 1796, the first engrossment through the HRD 1 amendment. Is there discussion? All those in favor signify by saying aye.
Aye.
All opposed, the motion prevails. We're now on the bill, and is there further discussion of the bill as amended? Okay. So Representative Earhart recommends that House File 1796 as amended be referred to the Committee on Ways and Means. All those in favor signify by saying aye.
Aye.
Aye. Aye. All opposed? The motion prevails. So thank you very much for two good discussions, members.
Thank you.
And so Wednesday, our next meeting is going to be Wednesday. If the DFLers still have some time here, DFLers, we'll go up to the research conference room on the fourth floor for just about a 10-minute meeting. Representative Beard?
Yeah, Mr. Chair, if I could just ask GOP members to step into 208 for a moment. We'll talk about a few things. And
okay.
There.
Good. And just a reminder then, so Wednesday we'll do the transportation finance bill in the morning and amendments in the evening. And with that, this meeting is adjourned.